Today is Thursday, July 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. A plot is uncovered to kidnap a VOA Persian service journalist on American soil.
But the FBI actually told me like 8 months ago that you're not safe in your house.
Plus a blast in Pakistan kills at least 13.
It was not immediately clear whether the blast was the result of a roadside device or something planted inside the bus.
And how the COVID-19 pandemic continues to overwhelm some hospital systems. We'll have these stories and more next. A VOA Persian TV host and outspoken Iranian government critic who says she was the target of a U.S.-exposed uranium plot to kidnap her has shared new details of the conspiracy, including its alleged aims at eliminating her and her popular social media accounts. Massey Alinejad shared the details with VOA.
I know that the Islamic Republic actually had a plan to kidnap me from New York. I still cannot believe it myself, but the FBI actually told me like 8 months ago that you're not safe in your house. I was like making joke of that and saying that, look, I receive daily death threats. What do you mean? What's new? And they came to me later. They showed me so many photos and film about my private life. Like the intelligence service sent someone here, hired someone here to take photos of me, my stepchildren, my husband, my beautiful garden in Brooklyn. And the FBI told me that you have to go to safe house. I did, but they asked me, you know, not to mention about this online. They asked me to go live on Instagram because they wanted to find out whether the intelligence service is gonna find out where I am. And they did. So that is why they changed my safe house again. But what is more is scary that the Iranian government actually charged three people. When I saw their pictures just last night, I got goosebumps. I was like, wow, I thought that I'm going to be safe in America. But this is the nature of the Islamic Republic.
Did you ever feel like you were being followed?
To be honest, I never had a feeling that I am being followed by anyone. That was the FBI actually came to me and showed me all the information. But in my daily life, like many activists, many journalists, I have been bullied, I have been harassed, I've been receiving death threats. The government in Iran actually went after my family. They interrogated my 17-year-old mother. They arrested my brother for my own activities. They actually brought my sister on Iranian national television to disown me publicly. So I knew that they hate me, but I didn't know that when they see all those pressure is not going to work, they're going to come after me in America.
Are you feeling safe now that this has happened?
To be honest, I want to say that when the FBI is protecting me, I'm under the protection, I feel safe. But when the Islamic Republic is in power, not only me, I think none of the Iranian citizens who are actually challenging the government and saying no to religious dictatorship is safe here in America or in Europe.
What is it exactly that you've done inside VOA and outside of VOA as an activist that has affected the Iranian government so much and they've become so sensitive to?
To be honest, I'm not a criminal. I'm a journalist, and my biggest crime is just give voice to voiceless people. That's all. I have been interviewing the families of those people who got killed in Iran protests. You know, last November, there were 1,500 people, according to Reuters, got shot and killed. So I just give platform to the mothers of these people. I gave the platform to the women inside Iran who are saying no to forced hijab, who are actually saying that in 21st century, we want to enter a stadium. We want to have the right to sing. We want to have the right to dance. They just want to have a normal life. I'll give the platform to the people inside Iran who say no to the Islamic Republic. Is that a crime? I'm simply doing my job. Simply being a journalist is a crime in the eyes of the Islamic Republic. And I want to say that the government, they're not scared of me. They're scared of the people who are willing, you know, to speak up.
Masih Alinejad is the host of Tablet on the VOA Persian service. It's a show where she discusses Iran's social and cultural problems, including restrictions imposed by its ruling Shiite clerics on women's rights and press freedom. Acting VOA Director for Programming John Lipman said VOA's security office was notified of the threat to Alinejad last year. The Iranian Foreign Ministry called the claims baseless. And speaking to reporters at the White House, Press Secretary Jen Psaki on Wednesday said the administration condemned the plot to kidnap an American on American soil, calling it dangerous and despicable.
We will forcefully defend U.S. citizens and U.S. interests. That includes law enforcement actions like the one announced yesterday, as well as the actions the president has taken to defend U.S. forces in the region from Iranian-backed militant groups.
The Justice Department, which oversees the FBI, said it declined to comment to VOA's Persian request for a response to Alinejad's account of her recent conversations with FBI agents. A blast in North Pakistan killed at least 13 people on a bus Wednesday, including 9 Chinese nationals. Beijing called the explosion a bomb attack, but Islamabad said it was a vehicle failure. Reuters' Lucy Fielder has that story.
More than a dozen people, including Chinese nationals and Pakistani soldiers, were killed in a blast targeting a bus in a remote region of northern Pakistan on Wednesday. That's according to multiple sources who said the toll could rise. It was not immediately clear whether the blast was the result of a roadside device or something planted inside the bus. Inspector General Muazzam Jah Ansari said the bus plunged into a ravine. Bomb disposal experts were at the scene, and police were investigating what he said looked like sabotage. Beijing condemned the blast and asked Pakistan to punish the perpetrators and protect the safety of Chinese personnel, institutions and projects. A senior administrative officer of the Hazara region said the bus was carrying more than 30 Chinese engineers to the site of the Dasu Dam in Upper Kohistan. The Dasu Hydroelectric Project is part of the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which is a $65 billion investment plan. It falls under Beijing's Belt and Road Initiative, aimed at connecting Western China to the Gwadar seaport in southern Pakistan.
Lucy Fielder reports for Reuters News. Taliban fighters in Afghanistan seized control of a major border crossing with Pakistan on Wednesday. In a video released by the group, the militants display their flag above the Friendship Gate at the border crossing in Afghanistan in the town of Wesh, which is located opposite the town of Chaman in Pakistan. The crossing is located in the Spin Baldock district, which is south of Kandahar. It's Afghanistan's second busiest port of entry and main commercial artery between the country's southwest and the Pakistani seaports. It's also used by some 900 trucks a day. Afghan officials speaking to Reuters said government forces had pushed back the Taliban and are in control of the district. But civilians and Pakistani officials told the news agency the Taliban remains in control of the crossing. As the United States withdraws its troops from Afghanistan, the Taliban is gaining ground in some rural areas. Thousands of locals in northern Afghanistan are joining the Afghan military to fight the Taliban in that region. Miguel Amaya narrates the story.
Clashes between the Afghan National Security Forces and the Taliban continue around northern Afghanistan's Jawzjan province. Local authorities say the fighting is within 30 kilometers of Jawzjan's capital city of Sherbagan, which houses over half of the province's population. Local militia forces have joined the Afghan military to defend their region against the Taliban.
These Uzbeks are facing the Taliban, and our people should not worry. We will drive the enemy out of the village soon.
While the Taliban continue to press hard in rural areas, local Afghan National Army commanders in Sherbagan City say that the Taliban have taken casualties in recent days and assure the locals that they will defend the region.
The Afghan people need to know that the military will sacrifice their blood and not hand over ground to the enemy.
Meanwhile, city residents took to the streets in support of the military and say that they will take part in the fighting if the government allows it.
We will uphold the rule of law and territorial integrity, and we will stand by our soldiers and protect them.
Everyone, young and old, depends on us to defend our country. We support our brothers. We will not allow looters to loot our property.
The local government says it is working on a plan to send volunteers to the front.
We thank and support those who have united to defend Afghanistan.
The Taliban had not yet commented on the clashes in the outskirts of Sherbagan. For Abdul Basir Ilgor in Sherbagan, Afghanistan, Miguel Amaya, VOA News.
The Biden administration is set to begin evacuations of Afghans who aided the U.S. military effort in the nearly 20-year war the U.S. fought in Afghanistan. Associated Press correspondent Ben Thomas has those details.
The senior administration official says the flights out of Afghanistan will be conducted during the last week of July. It's being called Operation Allies Refuge, and seats will be available first for special immigrant visa applicants already in the process of applying for U.S. residency. The evacuation could potentially affect tens of thousands of Afghans. Several thousand who worked for the U.S., plus their family members, are already in the application pipeline. The Biden administration has also been working on identifying a third country or U.S. territory that could host Afghans while their visa applications are processed. Ben Thomas, Washington.
The United Nations mission in Afghanistan says that it is increasingly concerned with the number of reported serious human rights abuses and violations alleged in communities most affected by the ongoing military offensive across the country. It's urging all parties to respect the human rights and dignity of all Afghans and says that the best way to end harm to civilians is for peace talks to resume. Former U.S. President George W. Bush says that the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan is a mistake. AP correspondent Rita Foley has that part of the story.
Former President Bush says he thinks the consequences of the U.S. and NATO withdrawal from Afghanistan will be unbelievably bad, to use his words. The war began under President Bush after the 9/11 attacks on the U.S. He said Afghan women are scared, and he says he fears they'll suffer unspeakable harm. The interpreters and others who helped U.S. troops will likely just be left behind, he said, to be slaughtered. And it breaks my heart, said the former president. President Bush spoke to the German broadcaster DW. I'm Rita Foley.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. The list of suspects in the July 7th assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse continues to grow. Authorities issued three new arrest warrants on Tuesday for Joseph Felix Badillo, Rodolphe Jaar, and John Joel Joseph on charges of murder, attempted murder, and armed burglary. Police have described the trio as armed and dangerous. The Associated Press has identified Joseph as a former senator in opposition to Moïse's Tet Kale party. The AP says that the three men are among five people still at large. Police Chief Leon Charles says police have arrested 18 Colombians and three Haitians in connection with the attack, including 63-year-old Christian Emmanuel Sanon, a Haitian-born man based in Florida, who police believe is the mastermind behind the plot to kill Moïse. Charles says Sanon arrived in Haiti on a private plane in early June with some of the Colombians. An official with the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency told VOA in an email statement that one of the suspects in custody was a confidential source to the agency but didn't identify the suspect. U.S. President Joe Biden has dispatched a special delegation to Haiti to assist with the investigation. The U.S. State Department's acting Deputy Assistant Secretary for Western Hemisphere Affairs is Laura Lockman. She spoke to VOA's Nike Ching on the events following the July 7th assassination of the Haitian president. Lockman is a member of the U.S. delegation that did travel to Haiti on Sunday and also discussed the plan for the multiple claimants by Haitian political leaders to meet later this week to discuss a solution for the political crises and name a new leader.
The United States, in conjunction with our international partners, we have been in constant contact with Haitian political leaders, encouraging them to come together and to have an inclusive, open process and form a unity government that it includes the private sector, civil society, as well as the various political parties. So we're very happy to hear that they're moving in that direction.
She added that the United States is urging the claimants to form an inclusive government and hope that new elections would occur in 2021.
We have always believed and actually continue to believe very strongly that it's imperative to hold elections for both the president and the legislature this year. And that is because there has been really a vacuum in democratic governance in Haiti that is not serving the needs of the Haitian people. There are many significant problems on the economic front, security front, political front now that need to be health front, that need to be dealt with in Haiti. And you need three functioning, fully staffed branches of government responsible to the Haitian people to take on those challenges.
Lachman also said that the U.S. government was reviewing requests for assistance from the Haitian government.
The Haitian acting prime minister did send a letter both to United Nations and to the United States prior to last weekend, asking for assistance in maintaining the safety of some of their critical infrastructure, as well as helping on election security and with the investigation of the assassination. So again, we're working internally within the U.S. government, as well as with our international partners, to coordinate with the Haitians on how best to respond to their requests.
The latest COVID-19 wave crept up on Myanmar, a country of 53 million, after the coup against elected leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Daily protests against the junta, strikes, and violence have all hampered the provision of health services. Reuters reporter Libby Hogan takes things from here.
Queues for oxygen cylinders in Myanmar are a stark reminder of a worsening COVID-19 crisis there. Myanmar is in the midst of its most serious wave of infections to date, with efforts to manage it hampered by nationwide chaos after the military coup. The junta said it had restricted supplies to individuals to avoid hoarding, rejecting accusations of trying to monopolize them. But some residents who spoke to Reuters said they are choosing to hole up in a room in their home rather than enter a quarantine center, a decision based on mistrust of the military healthcare system. Hospitals were under intense pressure even before the recent outbreak, with some reporting most of their medics had joined the anti-junta civil disobedience movement, striking in response to the military coup. In contrast, the ousted civilian government appeared to have had more success when the pandemic hit last year. People's willingness to submit to testing, tracking, and isolation helped to lower transmission rates. A spokesman for the military authorities said they were doing all they could and appealed for cooperation. One of the responses from the military has been opening military hospitals to the public and to step up services there. On Monday, daily cases topped 5,000 for the first time, more than double the highest figure last year. More than a third of COVID-19 tests were positive, a figure doctors say points to the outbreak being far more widespread than the official testing numbers indicate. Meanwhile, the military government said on Monday that vaccinations would now be stepped up, partly with help from its biggest foreign ally, Russia. Russia is among the few countries that have openly embraced the military government, which has been condemned globally over the coup and the deadly crackdown on pro-democracy protesters.
Libby Hogan of Reuters News. As the Delta variant spreads in record numbers across Indonesia, hospitals are overwhelmed. The situation is forcing many residents to care for sick family members themselves. VOA's Ahadian Utama reports.
This Jakarta resident spent hours in line in front of this refilling station before he finally got oxygen. It is so tough now. I have looked in many places. I have been here since this morning. They're only filling my tank now. Hundreds of people like David flock to this station as hospitals are bursting with more patients than they can handle. Many choose to self-isolate at home in the care of their family. These patients rely heavily on oxygen supplies. In Indonesia, oxygen tanks vary in sizes, from a portable half-liter to 6,000-liter tanks. Prices have gone up sixfold since the new coronavirus wave started here. But this station owner isn't raising his prices. But with demand more than double, he has put limit on how many tanks each customer can fill up. We used to cater to 40 to 60 people a day. Now it's 100 to 150 people. To refill, it's $1.25 per cubic meter, and we limit 5 tanks per customer. Many groups started helping with the shortage. One group of volunteers started Oxygen for People, a program to lend oxygen tanks to residents in dire need in Jakarta and the surrounding city for free. Within days, more than 1,500 people reached out to this group. We started this movement to respond to the situation in the last 2 weeks with the oxygen shortage. Those who need oxygen tanks just need to sign up on Google Form. We have an assessment team who will respond with necessary information and whether we can lend them a tank. Those who get it will have to agree they can only keep it for 7 days. Everything is for free.
Dipinjamkan oksigen atau tidak gitu.
One resident who came to this location in East Jakarta is very grateful for this program. Frankie recently lost his father to COVID and is trying to save another family member at home. I don't want to lose anyone else, so I will do my best. What's difficult is all refill stations are closed. This is so tough. Lives are lost because there's no oxygen. Now I have it, and I hope to give this miracle for my family. The Indonesian government has promised to step up the country's production and distributions of oxygen, as well as arrange for imports of oxygen tanks. For Indra Yoga, Ahadian Utama, VOA News.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. After months of fear in the Tigray region's capital city, occupied by Ethiopian and Eritrean forces, crowds of residents have rushed to the local security bureau to sign up to fight. AP correspondent Charles Della Desma has more.
Mekelle residents have been buoyed by the striking sight of a long parade of Ethiopian soldiers, now held as prisoners of war, and by Tigray leaders and soldiers in the city again. While the Tigray forces now control large areas, the region has remained largely cut off from the world, with transport and communications links severed or blocked. After months of looting and destruction, the UN is still highly concerned about the fate of millions of civilians as food runs short amid famine conditions. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
France's recent decision to close some of its military bases and reduce the number of its troops in Mali has sparked mixed reaction from the local population. Last week, French President Emmanuel Macron announced that his country would start closing 3 military bases in northern Mali by the end of 2021. French forces have been deployed to Mali since 2013 as part of its efforts to fight against militant groups in the country's north. France's Operation Serval, which was later changed to Operation Barkhane, has since expanded to include other countries in the rest of Sahel region. France said it would reduce its forces to 25 to 3,000 troops. There are currently 5,000 French troops in the region. In South Africa, civil society groups, citizens, and opposition parties have condemned the government's response to the ongoing violence in the country as shocking and a joke. What began as protests against the imprisonment of former President Jacob Zuma for refusing to answer questions at a commission of inquiry into corruption has now turned into mass civil unrest. Soldiers and police have not been able to stop large crowds of people from looting and destroying property. More than 70 people have been killed and hundreds injured. And the economy has lost billions of dollars. Darren Taylor reports.
From the police helicopter hovering above, it looks like a normal, everyday rush hour traffic jam on a highway on the outskirts of the port city of Durban. But the long lines of vehicles below are driven by people waiting for their turn to loot warehouses of home appliances, food, and other goods. One of the buildings is on fire, but still the looters stream in. Many South Africans are intensely disappointed and angry at the government's inability to stop the rioting and looting. Leader of the opposition Democratic Alliance, John Steenhuisen, is visiting Durban to assess the situation there.
It is really quite terrifying to see the absolute devastation, the complete destruction, but also the despair of many, many of the communities here who feel completely abandoned by the security services and who have been left to fend for themselves. Buildings have been burnt down. Bodies are literally strewn, lying in the road. This is clearly a situation that is not under control. It's not getting any better.
Free State University Chancellor Bonang Mohale agrees.
It is heartbreaking to see people strolling casually with empty trolleys. When they come back, trolleys the size of a triple-story house, and they take it to cars that are parked as if this is a normal Sunday afternoon shopping. People carrying refrigerators on their heads, an entire cow on their shoulders, flat screens everywhere.
Mohale says the country's paying now for the ruling African National Congress's continued protection of corrupt and incompetent leaders.
Everywhere for the last 15 years, at least, we are seeing black graduates roaming the streets absolutely hopelessly. Inequality has actually widened. Racism is at an all-time high. Public schooling has collapsed. Public healthcare continue to fail the poor and the vulnerable. What were we expecting when this ANC-led government...
Wits University governance expert Judith February says citizens don't trust the police service they see as brutal and corrupt. This has been reinforced by images of police officers joining the looting. Given that, says February, and also because citizens believe political leaders have stolen from the state for 20 years, the current anarchy makes total sense.
This is a country which is steeped in impunity. Our roots are in impunity. Our roots are also deeply in violence. If you look at any of the local government research, I mean, what people tell you is they only come when we start to burn things. The participatory democracy that the Constitution envisages and talks about, that's largely been broken by corruption, by an inability of the state to actually deliver to people.
Over the past few days, the state has deployed the army in Johannesburg, but there are no soldiers visible at places that continue to be attacked and pillaged in Durban and the nearby city of Pietermaritzburg. Security officials told VOA this is because they've received intelligence that mobs are now planning to attack key installations such as harbors and airports, and so the army's guarding these. Steenhuisen says this is good, but not good enough.
My real fear is that if we don't contain the situation here in KwaZulu-Natal, this is going to spread like wildfire around the rest of the country.
This is already unfolding, with looting and corresponding destruction now happening in cities and towns in several regions. The violence has halted South Africa's COVID-19 vaccination rollout and is now causing food and fuel shortages. In many areas, people can't get cash because banks and ATMs are closed. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The International Organization for Migration said Wednesday that deaths among maritime migration routes to Europe have more than doubled in the first half of this year compared to the same period in 2020. Sabina Castelfranco rounds us out.
The International Organization for Migration, IOM, is concerned with the increase in deaths on maritime migration routes to Europe. The organization said Wednesday that at least 1,146 people died attempting to reach Europe in the first 6 months of 2021, adding that the number has more than doubled compared to the same period last year. Most of those who died trying to reach Europe were attempting to cross the Mediterranean. Many of the migrants departed from Tunisia, headed for Italy. Italy is very concerned about the increasing arrivals. Interior Minister Luciana Lamorgese said that in July, the arrivals from Tunisia have multiplied due to that country's deep economic crisis. IOM Director General Antonio Vitorino called on countries to take urgent measures to prevent loss of life. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. And on behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.